This is a podcast from the Royal Air Force Museum. For further information, please go to www.rafmuseum.org/podcasts.
Welcome to the Royal Air Force Museum podcast on the Royal Air Force in 1918. The Royal Air Force was formed on the 1st of April 1918 as the Independent Air Arm of Britain's Armed Forces, amalgamating the Royal Flying Corps, or RFC, and the Royal Naval Air Service, or RNAS. This momentous event was met with very little fanfare or celebration, for the First World War had reached a critical point and efforts were, understandably, concentrated elsewhere. Just over a week before, the German army had broken through the British front line on the Somme, and both the British and French armies were in full retreat. The outcome of the war hung in the balance. The British Army had been experimenting with aviation for a number of years, with the establishment of the School of Ballooning in 1888. They used tethered balloons for observation and later, in 1907, free-flying airships. Then, in 1908, Samuel Cody had made the first powered flight in Britain in British Army Aeroplane No. 1, marking the start of a new era for aviation in the UK. The initial military reaction was rather restrained, as many were sceptical about the capabilities of the aeroplane for military use. However, in 1911, the Royal Navy began experimenting with both aeroplanes and airships. A year later, in 1912, the Army followed suit with the creation of the Royal Flying Corps from the Air Battalion of the Royal Engineers. The RFC had both a military wing and a naval wing. However, given the rivalry that existed between the Army and the Navy, it was perhaps inevitable that this situation could not be maintained. Citing differing priorities to that of the Army, the Royal Navy formed its separate wing in July 1914, renaming it the Royal Naval Air Service. In August 1914, the First World War broke out. Units from the RFC were sent to France to fly reconnaissance operations in support of the Army. The RNAS took up the traditional role of the Royal Navy by protecting Britain from attack. Initially, this included attacking German Zeppelin airship sheds, because the airships had been bombing towns and cities in southeast England. Throughout 1915, the roles of the air arms developed, and, as well as scouting for targets, aircraft also started to bomb them. They soon began to carry guns in order to attack enemy reconnaissance and bomber aircraft. By 1916, both sides were deploying hundreds of aircraft in Europe and the Middle East, with designated fighter, bomber, and reconnaissance types. The latter were using new radio technology to direct artillery fire. At home, the RNAS increased patrols in the North Sea and the English Channel in the campaign against the German submarines that were threatening British supply lines. By 1917, it was becoming clear that the system of operating two air forces was not working. Although the two forces had cooperated in northern France and Belgium, there were still gaps and rivalries in the way they operated. The ordering and procurement of aircraft was a major issue, with the RFC often facing equipment shortages, while the RNAS had machines and men that were underutilised. It was also clear the home defence was disorganised to a dangerous extent, with German airships and aeroplanes making raids on London, the South East and East Anglia. As a result, South African General Jan Smuts was asked to write a report on Britain's air forces and to look at ways in which they could be improved. The Smuts report recommended the establishment of a government department to regulate aviation and a united, independent air force. So, in January 1918, the Air Ministry was formed, followed in April by the Royal Air Force. The new Royal Air Force took over organisation of some 29,000 officers and 211,000 other ranks. In addition, there are around 10,000 members of the Women's Royal Air Force, which was formed on the same day. As well as people, the RAF had over 22,000 aircraft, though most were used for training or instructional purposes, with just 3,000 employed on frontline operations. As of the 1st of April, there are 59 squadrons based in the UK, either being formed or on home defence duties, as well as dozens of training units. In addition, there are another 74 frontline squadrons spread across the globe, 56 of them on the Western Front, 8 each in Palestine and Italy, 6 each in Salonika and Mesopotamia, 2 in India, and 1 in East Africa. There was also extensive training organisations in Canada, Egypt, and even America. The squadron was the basic unit of the RAF, consisting of around a dozen aircraft. Squadrons were grouped into wings based on their location. There were core wings, comprising mostly artillery spotting aircraft that were attached to a particular army corps, and army wings, using mostly fighters or light bombers that had a more free-ranging remit to look for trouble. The ethos of the RAF was aggression, and standard operating area for RAF units was on the far side of the front lines, seeking out the enemy. With the combined RAF came a proper division of effort and labour. From the chaotic overlapping parts of the RFC and RNAS emerged 4 distinct areas of operation. Although the immense training and logistical organisations that kept these areas supplied with men and equipment should not be overlooked. The first area was, of course, on the front lines, supporting the army in the field. Although the work of fighter squadrons was important, the backbone of the RAF's field operations was reconnaissance work. The fighters were there primarily to protect the reconnaissance aircraft and shoot down enemy reconnaissance aircraft. With a bird's eye view, reconnaissance aeroplanes could see things that the enemy would rather keep hidden, such as troop concentrations, artillery batteries, supply dumps, railways, and so on. Finding and plotting these would provide vital intelligence, making it clear where the next attack would fall, or showing where the enemy was weakest. Once these targets were found, aircraft could bomb them or direct artillery fire onto them. In 1914, reconnaissance work was carried out by aircraft such as the Blériot 11 monoplane, or the BE-2C. The former had a top speed of 100 kilometres an hour and a ceiling of 1,000 metres, while the latter could reach 116 kilometres an hour and flew at around 3,000 metres. Neither of these aircraft were armed, and communication with the ground involved dropping weighted messages over the side of the cockpit. By 1918, aircraft like the RE-8 were used for reconnaissance. It could fly at 160 kilometres an hour and at 4,000 metres and carried a machine gun for protection. The more advanced Bristol F2B fighter could reach speeds of 200 kilometres an hour at 6,500 metres, was armed with forward firing guns and a rear turret. It could also carry over 100 kilograms of bombs. Offering further protection to the reconnaissance aircraft were purpose-built fighter aircraft. This was a new concept, only really emerging in 1916. But already aircraft such as the Sopwith Camel or Royal Aircraft Factory SE-5A had developed, both of which could fly at 200 kilometres an hour at 6,000 metres. They were highly manoeuvrable and heavily armed with 2 machine guns and an additional small bomb load if necessary. By 1918, each side was deploying formations of fighter aircraft to seek out the enemy and destroy them en masse. This way they could achieve air superiority and allow their reconnaissance aircraft to operate unhindered. In the spring and summer of 1918, the German army broke through on the Western Front, putting to good use this combination of fighter and reconnaissance aircraft. It had never been more important to find out where the enemy was employed or where the next blow may fall. Meanwhile, every aircraft that could carry guns or bombs was being sent out repeatedly to bomb and strafe the advancing Germans, their supply lines and support troops. These ground attack operations were costly, with as many as 30% of aircraft dispatched failing to return each day. But they had a devastating effect on the German advance. Further behind the front lines, a new force was being formed to open the second area of operations. This was the Independent Force, and its role would be strategic bombing. From June 1918, the Independent Force began to wage long-distance war against targets deep behind enemy lines. Factories, railways, and other industrial targets were bombed day and night. Aircraft used included the de Havilland DH-9, which could fly for more than 5 hours at 200 kilometres an hour and carry 300 kilograms of bombs, plus two machine guns for protection. The Hanley Page 0400 was even bigger, flying up to 9 hours with over 900 kilograms of bombs and five machine guns to protect itself. Among the crewmen undertaking these long and arduous operations was Captain William Earl Johns, who would later immortalise the First World War Royal Air Force in a series of short stories following the career of James Bigglesworth, or Biggles to his friends. The third area of operations was the maritime role inherited from the RNAS, which took two forms. First was the anti-submarine net, known as the Spider's Web, that covered the North Sea. German submarines coming down through this area could get into the English Channel and cause havoc among the supply columns which supported Britain's forces in France. By 1918, flying boats such as the Felixstowe F3 were being used to patrol the area looking for German submarines. The F3 could carry a four-man crew plus four machine guns and over 400 kilograms of bombs, patrolling for up to 6 hours. This range could be extended by using warships to tow them to and from their patrol zones, giving them more time to actually hunt for submarines. These patrols also proved useful against Zeppelins, which often patrolled the same areas as the RAF. Several were shot down by anti-submarine patrols. The other maritime role was the direct support to the Royal Navy. Seaplanes and converted fighters could be operated from warships or specially converted freighters. They functioned as the eyes and ears of the fleet, seeking out enemy shipping, or, as weapons themselves, attacking enemy ships and land bases. The workhorse for this role was the Short 184, which had first entered service in 1915. Although obsolete by most standards, it could carry over 200 kilograms of bombs or a 14-inch torpedo, and was still an incredibly effective aircraft. In fact, in 1915, it had become the first aeroplane to sink a ship with a torpedo. The final area of operations was home defence. Since 1915, the Germans had launched regular air raids on the UK, first of all with Zeppelins, and then from 1917 with Gotha bombers. The Zeppelins, though large, were notoriously difficult to intercept and shoot down, so much of the defence against them was based around RNAS attacks on their bases in Germany. Gradually, British aircraft developed the speed and armament to attack these airships, hence the Germans changed to using Gotha aeroplanes to raid Britain instead. Gotha attacks were devastating. On the 25th of May 1917, nearly 100 people were killed and a further 200 were injured on a raid on Folkestone. Two further attacks, both on London, claimed more than 200 lives as well as over 600 injured. All three attacks had been made in daylight, yet the Germans lost only two bombers to the British defences. Once the air defences were brought under the single command of the RAF, things improved. On the night of the 19th of May 1918, the Germans launched their largest raid of the war, sending 38 Gothas to attack London. Despite the darkness, six were shot down by the British, a loss rate that persuaded the Germans to end their raids on Britain. The contribution of the Women's Royal Air Force during this time should not be overlooked. Women had been supporting the armed forces since the start of the war as unpaid volunteers through organisations such as the Women's Volunteer Reserve and the Women's Legion, which supplied workers such as cooks and drivers. In March 1917, the army formalised their female staff in France into the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, and its work was extended to the UK in the summer of 1917. In November 1917, the Royal Navy followed suit by creating the Women's Royal Naval Service, known as the WRENS. It was, however, far from inevitable that the new RAF would have a female contingent. Nevertheless, following much political wrangling, the need for such a force was recognised, and the Women's Royal Air Force was formed alongside the RAF on the 1st of April 1918. Personnel within the Women's Legion, the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, and the Women's Royal Naval Service were offered the opportunity to transfer into the new organisation, and fresh recruits were also enrolled. Initially formed with over 10,000 women, by its disbandment on the 1st of April 1920, 32,000 women had served in its ranks, with 1,000 of these serving overseas. Apart from the more traditional administrative or domestic trades, such as clerks and cooks, women could serve as pigeon keepers, engine fitters, welders, photographers and meteorologists, performing a vital role in keeping the RAF operational. The new Royal Air Force was formed at a time when aviation technology was in its early infancy. The First World War developed the military and transport role of aircraft. Flying had begun as a thrilling novelty and had become a viable means of transportation. Aircraft had become reliable machines, capable of carrying great weights. The end of the war saw the RAF establish such things as scheduled passenger services to and from the peace treaty talks in Paris, the first international scheduled passenger services in the world. While it is certainly true that most developments in aviation technology were initially intended to support military objectives, the peace dividend would eventually secure ever-widening access to commercial flights for business, pleasure and humanitarian purposes, all as a result of that early pioneering work done by the newest of armed forces.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the Royal Air Force Museum.